AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
All right. Bob Mata, defense attorney. And as you also may know, he's got the podcast Buried, all about John Wayne Gacy, all about the cassette tapes that he received from his father, who was one of Gacy's attorneys. And on those cassette tapes, the words of John, things people had never heard before, never will again, things about the case that were never even part of the trial. There's so many interesting nuggets in this podcast. If you're a fan of Gacy, but if you're interested in the case, it is certainly definitely worth checking out, especially if you just got a chance to watch Devil in Disguise or have seen the doc or the series out on Peacock right now. And incidentally, Bob is with us along with Stacey Cole and Todd Michaels. Bob, welcome. We've been talking about doing this for a while now, talking about the Gacy tapes. And why not now more than ever with everybody buzzing about it? For those who don't know, just kind of give us a little backstory on you getting a hold of these tapes from your dad. How did this all go down?
So my dad, back in 79 and 80, was one of Gacy's two trial attorneys. So Sam Amaranti, who had done other work that wasn't related to crimes for Gacy and his contracting business, put together little contracts for him. You know, if there were little people in terms of small claims stuff that weren't paying him, he'd file suit for him. So they had a relationship, a business relationship prior to the shit going down with Gacy. So when they start tailing Gacy in 1978 in December, he ends up reaching out to Sam and he's like, "Hey, Sam, you know, these fucking cops, man, they're following me around. They've been doing it for like a week. Is there like anything we can do about it?" And Sam's like, at that point, Sam had left the public defender's office and hung his own shingle. Okay. Like pretty recently. And Sam wasn't as, he wasn't as long in the tooth in terms of trying criminal cases as my father was. So when Sam kind of gets involved, no one knows at that point that Gacy's the monster that he is. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just like, they're saying that I kidnapped this fucking kid and I didn't do it. And they're following me around 24/7. They're sitting on my house. They're following me into restaurants, you know, help me. So Sam ultimately goes and talks to Terry Sullivan, who's the prosecutor in Rolling Meadows, which is the third district up in that area where Gacy lived. And he is saying, "What's going on, man? Like, why are you tailing this guy? You guys already did a search of his house on the 13th of December. You didn't find shit. Like, why are you hounding my client?" And they're like, "Cause we think he did it. Like, he's the last person that the kid said he was going to talk to, and he vanished off the face of the earth. We're going to keep following him. We're not stopping the tail. Sam's like, okay, fuck you. I'm filing a TRO. So as you're leading into that following Monday, Sam, at that point, is getting panicked because the case breaks on the 12th. I had flown in. My parents were divorced. It was winter break. I'm sitting in my dad's living room with my father and my uncle when the story breaks on the news, 10 o'clock news in Chicago. They're going through. They've got the camera trained on the house. They show the first remains being brought out of the house. They're like, oh, my God, there's a house here in unincorporated Norridge. It appears that they're removing remains from the house. The media has no idea what's going on. The Robert Peace story wasn't like a big deal in the media at that point in terms of the abduction and the fact that he disappeared, because that's how they treated missing kids back in the 70s, man. It wasn't like it wasn't news, right, until it became a thing. So at some point during the evening, as this breaking story, they continue to cover it. Sam, who is unmistakable because he's like 5'3", 5'4". He's a very short guy. Sam comes on camera for a short interview. And my dad's like, holy shit, it's Sam. I know Sam. And so my dad's like, and again, at this point, we have no idea what kind of monster Gacy is, right?
Sure. It's just another news story.
Another news story. Potentially this guy had a body in his house. So like, he's good for one thing. At least it looks like it. So my dad, so as it progresses, and they, I think that first night they pull out two of the victims' remains that night. Okay. Cause it's dark out. The crawl space is maybe 2.5 feet clearance. It's very difficult to be down in there. It's obviously pitch black. There is no smell, which is something that we'll get into later. But, you know, because most of these remains are skeletal that they end up finding, if not all of them. And there had been 900 pounds of lime that had been spread out in that crawl space in June of that year of 78. So there was no rotting flesh smell, okay? Mm-hmm. Which is an important thing that I want you to remember when we get to the second warrant.
Okay. But
at any rate, my old man, to answer your question, says, should I send a Western Union to Sam to see if he needs help on the case? And I'm 10 and I'm like, yeah, dad. I'm like, you'll be on the news. You know, yeah, that's how, you know, I don't know. I don't know shit from shit. I'm 10, you know? So, and my father, for all the years after, he's like, always kind of blamed me for him being on that case. He's like, yeah, you know, Bob, you really encouraged me. So needless to say, the following day, my father goes out, because this is obviously pre-cell phone, pre-internet, pre-email, pre-fax, all pre-everything, goes out and sends Sam a Western Union. Now, if you watch it on Peacock, that was one of the things that they fictionalized, where they had Sam on the phone calling lawyer after lawyer after lawyer after lawyer, and every lawyer's like, no. My dad is like, as soon as that story broke, the following day sent the Western Union telegram to Sam. Sam calls him back immediately. He's like, yes, I need help. When that call takes place, my father had also just hung his shingle, left the public defender's office, except Sam was in the 3rd District up in Rolling Meadows, which is a suburban. You're not dealing with the kind of shit that you deal with in the House of Pain, which is 26 and Cal in Chicago. That's where my father was the lead felony private or public defender. So my father was very seasoned litigator, was a phenomenal attorney. And Sam was all about him coming on board because Sam needed the help. And again, even at this point, they still have no idea what they're dealing with. Like they, like at this point, maybe they have 3 bodies because they're uncovering them in the crawl space. It takes a lot of time. They're going slowly. They're, you know, you have body on top of body. So you have bones that are laying on top of bones, and you're dealing with this concept of at some point being able to try to identify these victims, where we don't have DNA at that point, where you have basically medical records, dental records, and if the kids were wearing something unique, a belt buckle, a necklace that somebody had given them. So they're trying to be as careful as they can when they're removing these bodies, understanding you know, the medical examiner there is really overseeing everything. So they're being very, very methodical about trying to get the remains out. So Sam calls my dad after he gets the Western Union, and my father like freaks out, like kind of like he's like he gets nervous about it. And he initially says, well, he's like, you know what? Like I've got a bunch of stuff going on. Like I've got other cases I got to handle. Like I don't think I could do it. And he hangs up the phone, sits back in his chair. And this is all gospel. This is all true. None of this is fictionalized.
Sure.
Thinks about it for like about 10 minutes, picks the phone back up and he tells Sam, all right, yeah, I'll do it. And so Sam tells my dad, the first thing I need you to do is you need to file a motion in the court to get them to quit calling Gacy crazy on the news. And my dad says, well, Sam, there's this little thing called the First Amendment. They're going to be allowed to say whatever. There's nothing that I can file that's going to be able to stop them in terms of what they're going to say while they're doing the investigation, because at that point, the thought of a gag wasn't even a thing, mm-hmm. you know, really. So my dad writes up whatever he can, files it. And from there on, you know, the case just starts growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's like, just like this nightmarish case. And they realize very, very early that this is going to be an insanity defense case, you know, because of the fact that Gacy, as soon as he's taken into custody, with Amaranti not being with him in the initial hours, even though he was retained, I'm a little bit tough on Sam in my podcast, and I get progressively tougher on him from a defense attorney's perspective, looking objectively at the handling of the case in the early days, you know, that he wasn't there and for the initial interrogation and confessions by Gacy, wherein he made some admissions purportedly, because mm-hmm. none of the interrogations were videotaped. None of them were handwritten confessions from Gacy and signed. They were all based on a report written by Mike Albrecht, who was the one that was conducting the interrogation. Now on my podcast, Mike was the second cop who I interviewed, and I love Mike Albrecht. Like all of these old Des Plaines cops were salt of the earth, good guys, and exceptionally honest about the faults of the department and policing back in the 70s and how they just were disregarding missing kids and just, you know, chalking it off to them moving out to California and, you know, or if it was had anything to do with, you know, in their estimation, homosexuality, and the kids would be, you know, they're gay. It was a gay fight. We don't give a shit about that. Or it was socioeconomic in the sense that these aren't folks with money, so we're just not going to put the resources in it because we don't care. Like those types of things were real, and it was taking place, and it went on for years, which is what allowed Gacy to continue to operate, because there's a misnomer that Gacy was under the radar. Multiple people had gone in, because as we had Patrick McManus on along with Michael Chernus on your show last week, and he was talking about this fact that, you know, there were thousands. Gacy hooked up with thousands of guys. It was like this dude was a disgusting apex predator machine that would just go out and just could not get enough. He was a glutton, like a sex addict, like everything. He just had to have more of everything. And you know, a lot of these kids survived. So you had a lot of survivors. You have the Jeff Rignall, who was kept hostage for 2 days in Gacy's shed, being tortured and, you know, repeatedly chloroformed and like made to be knocked out while he's passed out. They're sexually abusing him. And he goes into the cops and they're like, how are we going to find this guy? So Jeff Rignall goes and sits on an overpass for a week and waits, because he knows what Gacy's car looks like. Waits literally for this car to drive by, and then one day, unbelievably, it does, and he runs back to the police station with the plate. Says, "Here's the fucking plate for the guy that just nearly killed me and completely tortured me for 2 days." They end up charging Gacy on that case with simple assault. Just to let you know where the mindset of Chicago police was at that time.
If they had made a different decision at that point.
And Rignall was late. Like, if you listen to my episode 3, which I'm not going to give any spoilers, I implore everybody, don't skip right to it. Listen from the beginning. But episode 3 lays it out. They should have had Gacy under arrest by Robert, by the third victim, John Bukovich. They had everything they needed. Any competent cop, had they followed through with any kind of investigation, would have had Gacy dead to rights. They would have gotten a warrant. They would have gotten into that house. They would have gotten into the shed. His father, and I'll talk about Johnny Bukovich, called the Chicago police every week for 2 years, begging them to look at John Bukovich's boss. Because that's the other thing with Gacy, is that the way that they tried to portray it initially in the press, through the words of law enforcement, that these were all wayward kids, that they were all street hustlers, that they were all, you know, out there selling themselves for money and hustling. And that's just not true. Plenty of Gacy's victims were young men that were just trying to work and make a living in a very difficult economic time, making $5 an hour because Gacy paid better than most. And he always had a type. He'd always hire his type in terms of the kids that were doing the contracting work for him. And John Bukovich was one of those kids. And man, it was unbelievable. And you know, like, I'm going to let you ask me questions because I can go on.
I mean, it's amazing what, you know, just we look at policing today and we get very upset all the time at various things that seem to be falling through the cracks. You know, like the Aaron Spencer case, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But what was able to go on, what was able to thrive back then, I think our minds would be blown today if it was going on like that. But because of the world that we lived in, and the lack of technology, the lack of modern policing, the lack of new more efficient ways of doing things, people like Gacy were allowed to thrive in ways that I don't know that we're ever going to see another Gacy again, simply because our world has changed so much. What do you think about that?
It's odd that you say that. So in the epilogue, which was the final thing after our final episode, which is 33 plus 3, because we wanted to memorialize the victims, which there were 33 that we know of. Happen to believe that there's additional victims, because that's another part of the investigation that we'll talk about in a second, that just did not happen. But the last episode, it's me and my producer who was doing this boots on the ground investigation with me. We had that exact conversation. If Gacy were operating in today's time with the technology and everything that exists in the world that we live in, how many do you think that he would have gotten away with? And, you know, I was at like 2, maybe 3. If he's really focusing on people that are off the grid, you know, if you've got one kid whose family is all over it and who is up law enforcement's ass, like Miss Peast, who was Gacy's last victim, she was all over them. And she's like, my son didn't fucking run away. Don't you dare tell me my son ran away. He's a honor roll student. It's my birthday. My son would never do that. Something has happened to him. Fucking find my kid. And they did, you know. So if you had a parent like that, and with an Amber Alert, because even if you're 16, 17, you go missing, there's an Amber Alert. They're going to be getting Gacy's phone. Like he just wouldn't have been able to get away with it. It wouldn't happen. It's like in our world now, to me, the only serial killers that can really succeed, for lack of a better term, in terms of having some kind of longevity in what they're doing, are probably truck drivers, over the road truck drivers that are constantly on the move, and people that commit these crimes in national parks, just because it's so off the grid. I mean, you have to be off the grid.
Yeah.
No, and even in those circumstances, you know, it's difficult if people are like, okay, well, my husband or my significant other or my son went hiking and now they're gone. Just the vast amount of land that has to be covered in order to discover the bodies takes forever. And sometimes they never find these folks. And you have to be able to find the body to know if that something criminal took place, that somebody was murdered, that it wasn't just an accident and somebody fell or what have you, or was you know, there was predation, an animal, whatever, you know, you have to know that a crime was committed before you're going to get the cops to investigate it. So like in those two circumstances, I can see in which, you know, that's kind of how Israel Keyes was able to kind of continue his, and we don't really even know how many he killed. You know, my buddy Josh Hallmark has a great podcast about him, and he's been just digging into that thing, that case, Israel Keyes, who's now dead, who killed himself when he was in jail. You know, he's been really trying to uncover how many victims just that guy was accountable for. And it's one of those things, like he was a national parks, near bodies of water type dude. So I think in this day and age, it's awfully tough for those guys to operate. Thankfully.
Stacey, your mic's muted. I thought she was.
Sorry.
Looks like sure.
Is that better?
Go ahead.
I had a little technical issue there for a second.
Go ahead.
Do we think that there's about 8 to 10 victims still unidentified at this point? Is that the number that they have?
There's five unidentified victims.
Five. So okay.
I was in the middle of the investigation and doing the podcast, and they identified Francis Alexander, which so there were six at that point. And through they used DNA Doe was the agency that was able to use IgG to be able to figure out who that was. They had submitted DNA from, I believe it was a jawbone, and they were able to develop a profile from it. From that profile, they then went in to use genealogical DNA in terms of using family trees to look back, find somebody that was somewhere on one of the databases, whether it be 23andMe or Ancestry.com, any of the private databases that allow people to allow their profiles to be shared in order to try to help missing cases and, you know, unidentified victims and John and Jane Doe's. So they were able to put that together, and then they had to put Francis in the city of Chicago. Which they were able to do, I believe, with a parking ticket. So they knew that he was in and around the area at that time. So that process, and you know, I was relentless with Jason Moran, who was heading that part of the investigation, as there's still these 40 years later, with all that we have developed in terms of technology and DNA technology specifically, and especially with labs like Othram Labs. You know, I was all over Jason Moran, who works with the Cook County Sheriff's Police. I'm like, what the fuck are you waiting for? I'm like, just get whatever you have over to Othram and let them develop profiles. Let's get these kids their names back. Let's give these families some type of closure. Like, why aren't you doing it? And it's still my pod. I originally released it prior to it's been 3+ years. Yeah. So, you know, it's inexplicable to me. Why that work's not being done, why the remains aren't in the hands of labs across this country that are going to be able to develop profiles from it, even after all these years.
But that problem exists well beyond just the Gacy case here, obviously. There's countless cases where there's evidence just sitting, waiting for these sort of tests to be done. Does it come down to manpower? Does it come down to money? Does it come down to interest to the families, especially in cases, you know, 40 plus years old, of people still being alive, of there being parents or siblings or someone that was closely connected to some of these victims that are still around, that are even aware that you can do these sort of things, that are pushing for these sort of tests to be done?
Yeah, I think all of those things are a factor, you know, truly. I mean, some of the kids might not even be in NamUs, you know. Yeah. Some of the kids may not have been ever reported as missing, so they're not in the database, you know. And as far as the funding part of it goes, in this day and age with crowdsourced funding, I believe that we'd be able to raise the capital for any type of case that would be required to get the lab to be able to do the work. I mean, I had David Middleman on our show a couple of months ago, and, you know, he's like, I never worry about the money side of it. Like, with crowdfunding, we'll be able to get the money, which I believe is 100% true. So, you know, but like all those things that you stated are impediments, you know, those are all things that create issues in terms of being able to get these missing persons identified. We're seeing incredible things though. You know, you see it on a daily basis, like DNA Doe Project. I always get emails when they have, I've identified somebody that's been missing or, you know, for 30, 40 years. I mean, Othram has identified, John and Jane Doe's that were 90-100 years missing. You know, it's incredible stuff, man. It's like there is no time limit in terms of how far back they can go. And then, you know, DNA is such a fascinating area of science in that, you know, we share, males share their YSTR chromosome with all of our ancestors, you know, and it mutates slightly, but it's close enough to where you're going, it's going to lead them to the right, like on the right path. And that's where IgG comes in. And that's where that, you know, that family tree thing looks at it. And they're going to be able to say, okay, well, somebody uploaded their DNA here and this person is a pretty close match, if not exactly. And so now let's work our way back looking through that family tree and figure out exactly who this person is. And that can be communicating with the people that uploaded the DNA profile and say, hey, you know, tell us who's in your family. Because, you know, obviously a lot of people don't do 23andMe or Ancestry.com. They don't get their DNA on profile. So you've got to do a lot of that manual legwork. But with AI,
I feel like we're on the cusp of like quite an amazing thing that's about to happen. And, like, and I'm wondering how many people out there, and number one, you're going to have a lot of families that are going to get answers to some of their questions. But I think you're also going to get families are going to get answers to their questions too in a different way of, remember Weird Uncle Charlie?
Yep. Like, that's right.
Yeah. Like that's it's right. Not always just going to be connecting those dots. It's going to be, oh God. Yeah, yes. There was a reason he was weird. He was doing this over there. Stacey, what are we looking at in the comments right now? What are some people asking about?
Yeah, Mark had a really good question. What other states do you think Gacy had killed in?
Wisconsin.
Ew.
Definitely. Yeah, I think.
Well, he's right there.
I know, but still. Like, come on.
He used to go up there very, very frequently. And there's a property that we know that he frequented that we at one point believed that Gacy had owned property up in Wisconsin. Yeah, because, I mean, it's a short drive. I mean, for us in Illinois, when we want to get away, that's where we go. You know, we go.
And then
we
everybody
in Wisconsin. Call you Fibbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just going to go there.
And to be honest with you, Mark, he traveled so much for work. It really requires a more in-depth investigation in terms of people that went missing at times that we know Gacy was in different states. Now, the one thing that you kind of like causes you some pause in terms of whether or not he was active when he was on the road is, you know, by way of him having this graveyard under his house, that wasn't him being clever. That was him being lazy, you know, and that it just worked out for him that, look, I was able to have this graveyard under here and it kept me off the radar until he ran out of room.
If he had had a bigger house, he may have had more victims.
Excuse me. Yeah, exactly. Well, ultimately the last five were dumped in the Des Plaines River when he ran out of room. So, I mean, we have all of his work records because he kept impeccable work records. So we know where he traveled. He was in Kansas City. He was all over the Midwest.
Yeah.
All the time. We were chasing lead down in Florida because we know that he was down in Florida at a time that a kid that was in the military went missing off the base. And he was down there around that time. I had done FOIA requests because that's the other part for us. Season one really was an examination of the failures of Chicago police and how Des Plaines was able to get this done in 10 days. I wanted to know why the fuck that happened. So, you know, we dug into the investigation heavily. We talked to all the old cops Chicago PD wouldn't touch us. I just flamethrow Chicago Police Department. Like, if you thought that they got hammered a little bit in Devil in Disguise, that's nothing compared to it. I lay waste to them because, again, I put obviously Gacy is the one whose hand was the one who committed the murders. But the fact is that he should have been in prison awaiting the death penalty at that point in time in 1973. And because of their indifference and their incompetence, that wasn't the case. So I put it on them. I put the blame on them for not doing the job. And it's like, you know, that thing where they were talking about, if you watch Devil in Disguise, oh, we couldn't communicate. Yeah, bullshit.
Right.
It's like nobody's buying it.
I'm curious because you had mentioned you think that he may have had property in Wisconsin. Do you know where he might have had property in Wisconsin?
We know of a location, one specific location that we know for a fact he was up there. I actually interviewed somebody on the podcast that considers themselves to have had a near-death experience with Gacy. The kid was it was up around Lake Delavan, actually, and the kid was his mom had told him to pull the boat out of the water, and Gacy was driving by. And the thing with Gacy is nobody knew it was Gacy until Gacy was arrested.
Sure. He's just another guy.
Yeah, right. So, but like when the story breaks and his face is plastered all over the news, that's where you get tons of people like, oh my God, do you remember that story I told you about that weird creep? That's the guy, you know? Yeah. So we had so many people calling us. And because we had a number, we wanted to hear from people, because the other part of this thing, like I said, I was investigating the investigation, but I was also very much looking forward to the second season, in which we are going to do what no law enforcement agency ever did on that case, is look beyond the house in the river and look for other victims, because we just do not believe that there was a period of time of 2 years where Gacy was not killing, which is what they've always kind of laid their hat on in terms of the victims that they've been able to identify and being able to pinpoint when they went missing, and saying, oh, well, he was dormant during these two years of time. He wasn't. He was married to Carol from 72 to 76. And from 76 to 78, he went insane. You know, that was his most documented clear killing period, where he killed the most victims. And during this period of time that Carol was living there, he was just making other arrangements. I'm confident of it. You know, we believe one of the properties that has, you know, allegedly there's been a dig that they pretended like they did a dig. We call it a sham dig, which was the Miami and Elston property, where he was a handyman in a building in which his mother lived in, where my partner on it, Bill Dorsch, had interviewed all these people that lived in that apartment. And these interviews are unbelievable. They're like, yeah, he'd be there at like 2 a.m. He'd dig these like super long trenches and he'd just leave them there for a couple of days. And then overnight he would come and fill them in, and there'd be like a 6-foot trench and there'd be like one small bush. So Bill, prior to my podcast, had snuck onto the property and done LIDAR, gotten the machine out there.
Yeah.
And they found some abnormalities, which the person that was running the machine's like, you should dig here. You know, and they were doing it all in the front yard. And so Bill just hounds and hounds and hounds of Cook County Sheriff's Police, goes to the media, trying to put pressure on them to conduct this dig. And they put up a little tent. They barricade it. As you can imagine, the press was massive. This is in 1994, shortly after Gacy was executed.
Yeah.
And so they put up this little tent. They invite the operator of the radar machine in there. And, you know, they say, okay, well, where should we dig? He says, okay, well, you don't need to dig here. Looking at, you know, his printout, he's like, and this is where I would dig. They say, okay, well, you can leave. And so for 15 minutes, they're in there by themselves. They come out with, you know, like a nut and a bolt and like a plate. They're like, yeah, there's nothing. Show's over. Everybody go away. So, you know, the significance is that Chicago doesn't want Gacy bodies. Chicago doesn't want potential liability for them not having done anything during the time that he was active. They have a vested interest in not finding any Gacy bodies. They put on a huge amount of pressure on anybody that is trying to continue the investigation. So but that's what we're doing. Like we are going to do, because there was no investigation when, like, if you think about when Rex Huterman was arrested, they immediately started looking into every possible place that he could have left victims behind. And that included Vegas, it included his brother's property down in South Carolina. They investigated it with Gacy. That did not take place. All that took place, and by the time this thing went to trial, was trying to identify the kids that were in that crawl space and trying to find the five that he had claimed that he had thrown in the river. And that was it. There was no investigation beyond that. They just assumed that that's all there is because that's where he put his bodies.
And that's, they don't.
So
it's another cover up. It's a cover up of not wanting exposure for incompetence, basically.
Right.
We're not doing their job. So there could very well be massive other chapters to this story that have not even been written yet because they haven't been discovered yet.
Yes. Yes. I saw Steve. Steven had asked, he was tied to the Candyman. So there's that podcast that came out called The Clown and the Candyman. And the Candyman is Dean Corll, who was down in Texas, who was a serial killer who had a almost identical modus operandi to Gacy, in the sense that it was all young men. It was he had two accomplices, one of which ultimately shot and killed Dean Corll in 1973. I've seen them try to make the connections. There are many, many people out there that believe firmly that there was a network, a much larger network of child sex trafficking ring that existed back then. You know, because we had John David Norman in Chicago, who was infamous. He was finally arrested, and they found that he had dossiers on thousands of kids from all around the country, from all around the Midwest, in terms of prospects for these predators. Unfortunately, all of those files unbelievably were destroyed. And there was a connection between John David Norman and John Gacy. And that was this guy named Paskey, Philip Paskey. Philip Paskey had a relationship with two guys that I firmly believe were John Wayne Gacy's accomplices in 1976 through 78. And that was David Cram and Michael Rossi, two kids that worked for Gacy, somehow survived it, but also lived with Gacy in that house during his most active time where he was killing. They were also on record having admitted that they had dug the trenches. They had also found out after they arrested Gacy that Michael Rossi was driving around, and Johnny Zick, who was one of Gacy's victims, another one of his employees that he killed, in John Zick's car for a fucking year.
And nobody really noticed this?
No one noticed anything.
Good God.
Gacy, dude, like, that's what I'm saying. The Peacock thing is wonderful. I thought, in terms of finally kind of exposing just how terrifying Gacy was, it's great, but it really just scratches the surface. We go so much deeper, man. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
So much more in it. Buried is the podcast. You can get it wherever you get podcasts. And also Defense Diaries is Bob's podcast as well, and YouTube channel. You can find that wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.